This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Boy, take your pick today, guys, because there's more than enough to choose from, and I think we'll probably go all over the place and cover it all in the next couple hours. We're going to get to some Jets, which we haven't even hit on as of yet with the news the last few days. But, you know, let's just mix it up, and we'll start, I guess, just to begin with the Yankees and the fact that they are just continuing to roll. And, Mr. Canty, they are doing it in just a ridiculously matter-of-fact fashion right now. And Gerrit Cole hasn't even been anywhere near at his best yet.
No, he hadn't been at his best yet, but he looked good in his Pinstripes debut, the first time pitching in Yankee Stadium for the Yankees. And he went out there and he had a solid performance. I mean, six innings, what, he had one earned run? I mean, you feel pretty good about that, only allowing five hits. I just think that Gerrit Cole has kind of been steady. He's been what the Yankees have needed. But the reality is there wasn't going to be a lot of pressure on Gerrit Cole in the regular season because you had a lineup that could manufacture a lot of offense. And that's the thing with the Yankees. You don't know where it's going to come from, but you know that somebody on any given night is going to be able to swing a hot bat and put up a lot of runs on the scoreboard. And that's exactly where Yankees pitchers find themselves. They get a lot of run support. And so Gerrit Cole has been what we need him to be. But more importantly, your lineup is producing runs. And last night, Gio Urshela came up with another huge home run, a three-run shot in the sixth that blew the game open. So, I mean, the Yankees always have somebody playing the hero. It's a different person almost on every given night, although Aaron Judge did have a streak of five straight games with home runs. But, I mean, there really aren't a whole lot of concerns about this Yankees team in the regular season because they are just that talented.
They're almost too good that it's boring at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the season's only started. I mean, just started, but it's almost like they're so good that there's really nothing, you know, overly interesting to talk about. I mean, Paxton's fastball is clearly a concern, but when you got, you know, you got Gardner hitting opposite field home runs, you got Stanton stealing bases. I mean, we're not even talking about
that. That was his first opposite field home run, right? Of his career, right?
I was just,
yeah, the balls
it was
are juiced.
Third. It was a third, but one of them was an inside the park home run.
The balls are juiced. We all know it, but that's fine. Take advantage of it. I mean, seriously, we're sitting here talking about, you know, how good the Yankees are, and they've been great. And Chris, to your point, I mean, it seems like it's, you know, it's someone different every single night. I mean, Judge, obviously, and what LeMahieu have been able to do, but we're not even, you know, we're not even talking about the fact that, you know, Gleyber Torres is struggling at the plate, and Gary Sanchez has been brutal at the plate. I mean, that isn't even a topic of conversation because they just do what the Yankees have been doing, is just mowing people down.
You know, it is kind of remarkable, to your point, about them being boring because there's not anything that you really look at that say this is a major problem for them moving forward because everybody, they are so deep in so many positions. They are so deep in terms of the lineup. They are, I guess you can look at the starting pitching and wonder about Paxton and wonder about Tanaka a little bit, but there's so much backing them up in the depth of the bullpen still. I mean, you know, people were worried about losing Tommy Canley, Chris. I don't even look at that as a major problem. They've got so much depth that goes even beyond the top 13 guys with pitching
well, you don't
overall.
Even have, Carly, you don't even have Sessa back and you don't have your closer.
Yeah.
But I mean, Chapman's still locked down. Coming back soon though, right?
Yeah, Chapman yeah. is going to throw. He's going to Scranton. And working his way back, but same and Sessa should be back soon. But this is the point. It is an embarrassment of riches, and it doesn't even become about winning 38 games. Now it becomes about are they going to win 50? I mean, they might.
Well, here's the thing, Carlin. I mean, as a Yankees fan, whether they win 38 games, whether they win 50 games, I could care less. It's all about positioning yourself to be able to go on a run in the postseason, having the most favorable matchups early on in the playoffs. And then just trying to find the path to a championship because that's how we're going to judge this team. Nobody cares about what the Yankees are going to do in July and August. What we care about is what they're going to do by the time the postseason rolls around. I mean, we've had expectations for this team. Brian Cashman has been talking about not compromising the window for a dynastic run for several years now, but you got to win one championship. And they haven't been able to get it done. Now, you can point to a lot of different reasons, the Astros sign-stealing scandal, the Red Sox with their cheating using electronics. But the reality is the Yankees have not won a championship, and we're waiting for this supremely talented team to be able to get it done. So everything that I see in the regular season, I look at through the lens of, is this something that I can rely on in the postseason? And so when I'm power ranking the list of concerns for the Yankees, at the top of them is James Paxton, because he's just not the same pitcher that we saw in the postseason last year.
But the good part about, I mean, the, I say good part, I mean, the luxury that you have with James Paxton is, you know, coming off the back surgery, I mean, clearly his, you know, his fastball isn't what you need it to be, but because, mm-hmm. you know, of the offensive support and the fact they just keep winning games, I mean, you have the luxury of keep putting him out there every fifth day until he figures it out.
Yep.
Because that's how good you are.
Yeah, and Tanaka is the guy that, with as a result of that, has to be what he normally is. And look, you look at his postseason, Tanaka's never a real concern in the playoffs. I mean, you're always going to feel very good about his situation. But look, that's the thing. We are down to the point of talking about the third starter for the postseason when we're so far away from it. But Chris, the other thing that bothers me about it, though, is really the way it's structured this year goes against the Yankees in every way. The fact that you're going to have the Yankees playing, if they were the top seed or the top two seeds in the American League, you're going to have them playing in the first round, and there's no true advantage between winning 50 games this year. There's really not, because all you're doing is getting the chance to stay home, but you're not going to have fans at the ballpark anyway. So
yeah, it feels like they are at a little bit of a disadvantage just because of how things shook out with how they had to structure the season, but I mean, under the circumstances, it is what it is. Nobody's going to make excuses for the Yankees. What I will say is the Phillies were in a tough spot last night, not having played a game in 8 days and then having to come to the Bronx to play against the Yankees. That was going to be a tall order. And, I mean, Jake Arrieta hadn't pitched a meaningful game going back to last August. So they had things stacked against them. And if you want to start questioning the integrity of the season and competitive balance, those are all valid questions, valid concerns for Rob Manfred in Major League Baseball. But again, it comes back to everybody is fighting against COVID-19. And so everybody is going to be made to feel a little bit uncomfortable, and nobody wants to hear excuses as to why you can't get it done. And as a Yankees fan, I don't look at the coronavirus as an out for the Yankees not living up to expectations in 2020.
I mean, this is a battle of attrition. I mean, that's really what it's going to come down to. I mean, you watched the Mets game last night. I mean, the Braves' best starting pitcher blows out his Achilles, and that's going to have a huge effect on their season. So it's going to be, I mean, as talented as the Yankees are, I mean, it's going to come down to, you know, them staying healthy. I think that's really the biggest concern for this team now moving forward.
Well, the Mets can't help but be interesting. They can't help but provide us with stuff to talk about, even when things aren't going. Let's start with the good, though, to be fair, in that they finally scored runs for DeGrom. They finally were hitting in the clutch in when opportunities presented themselves. And DeGrom was just as good as he usually is until he gave up the runs a little bit later. But look, I mean, with his money, he could give up five runs and he deserves them to score seven, just considering how well he has pitched. I think, you know, when you are the Mets and you go through all that you have gone through, if you're not taking advantage, this is kind of the bare minimum that you can do, Rick. I mean, the bare minimum is to score runs when you have the best pitcher in the National League on your team. And win games
the stat
when that's the case.
Did you see the stat on Twitter? I know we've talked about this over the last couple of years, but I was looking through Twitter last night, and it says that in 66 starts since 2018, Jacob DeGrom is 21-17. Had the Mets been able to score four runs per game for him in those starts, he would have been 59-3 with 4-0 decisions.
That's why I said,
that's how good he's been.
If Jacob DeGrom was pitching for the Yankees the last couple of years, you're talking about back-to-back 20-plus game winner. Like, that's what he would have been. There is no question in my mind.
He's probably on a streak like Cola's at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Oh, absolutely.
He's the best pitcher in baseball. I don't think that's even debatable, Ricky. I think he's the best pitcher in baseball.
And it looks like he got better. I mean, with his uptick in velocity. I mean, listen, we have the luxury of being in New York. We probably have, I mean, you could make the argument if you would like, but in my opinion, you got the best pitcher in the National League, clearly, and you got the best pitcher in the American League, all in the same city.
Yes.
And, I mean, just the fact that you now have to have some sort of drama infused into the situation. I mean, first of all the guys that are going to cause it, who would have ever thought that Brandon Nimmo would have been, you know, Mr. Goody Two Shoes himself would have been the guy that actually brought into question as to what happened with Cespedes and the players knew about it. But nonetheless, I mean, I know this is something that we say every time around, but can just once there be one side to a story and that's it and you move on from it? Does it always have to include some sort of drama, some sort of misstep by the organization to cause this, to cause something? The Mets are amazing at turning a non-story into a five-day story. I mean, like, if that was a stat, they would have a dynasty.
Yeah, but that's what I didn't understand. I mean, I get the fact that you were, you know, you were upset with how Yoenis Cespedes handled it, right? I mean, the fact that he just got up and, you know, just didn't even check out of the hotel and left, and you were trying to embarrass him. But, I mean, you failed in trying to embarrass him. I mean, you saw how people reacted to that initial report. It was like, hey, take a step back. Let's not kill the Mets yet. Let's not kill Cespedes. Let's make sure he's okay first. Like, that's what they did, and they did it to themselves. Yeah, I mean, how many tweets did you read? Like, people like, okay, relax, take a step back. Like, let's not make a joke out of this yet because we don't know if Cespedes is okay. If you knew the whole time he was fine and he was just upset with his at-bats and his playing time and he was going to decide to leave, that was not how you craft a statement.
Not at all. I mean, why cast a cloud over that situation if you know what it's about? I mean, and I have a hard time believing that the Mets didn't have any insight that Cespedes was upset about his contract, that he could potentially opt out and use COVID as the reason why he could get out. Like, to me, I think what Brody Van Wagenen did during the game was completely unnecessary. Like, to issue that statement saying that you don't know where he is, and then you come to find out exactly where he is during the course of the game, and then you wait until after the game to release another statement, that to me is Bush League. Like, I don't understand why you would want to create all of that uncertainty in a situation where you have a pretty good idea of why the player went AWOL. Like, that was completely unnecessary. And so, to me, yeah, Cespedes is the bad guy, no doubt. But I don't know why the Mets decided they were going to dive in the mud with Cespedes. Like, just let him be the bad guy in this situation. Everybody's going to read it for what it is. A guy that's being selfish, putting himself before his teammates and the club, and let that be that. I don't understand why Brody Van Wagenen felt like he needed to hang on the rim and try to issue a statement to make him seem even more selfish. That was completely unnecessary.
They actually turned him into a sympathetic figure in the situation, and that was hard to do. And, you know, I was thinking about this last night. You know, we always talk about how the Knicks are not an attractive place to come anymore because you have all the drama around them that happens. And as much as the sale you hope goes through, when you see management, when you see people handle situations like this, if you're another player, aren't you paying attention to this at some point? Aren't you saying that why would I want to go there if the money is remotely comparable when they can't get out of their own way on the easiest things? And they're going out of their way in this instance to make a player look bad when, in essence, the player could have just done it on his own, Rick.
Well, because, I mean, for the most part, I mean, the players that the Mets signed, I mean, they end up giving, you know, the extra year or two that they weren't going to get anywhere else. Right? I mean, where else was Jed Lowrie going to get that deal? Where was, you know, Todd Frazier going to get the extra year of that deal? I mean, it's like they give a retirement package to older players that don't have any other options.
Yeah, the return on investment for the Mets has been awful, especially when it comes to players that used to be represented by Brody Van Wagenen, like the Jed Lowrie deal and the Cespedes deal. I mean, when Mets fans take a look back at those contracts, those are going to be some of the worst contracts that were given out in franchise history. They're terrible.
The only thing that makes it attractive, Carlin, is if you're an older player, it's the extra year, the extra money. And if you're a younger player, or maybe even if you're an older player too, is it seems like you get to do whatever you want. Like there's no set of rules.
But you know what, Ricky? Maybe that'll end up changing though. Because when you do have a new owner, you'll potentially have new management. Because I find it hard to believe that whoever owns the team is going to look at the job that Brody's done the last couple of years and think that he deserves the right to be the general manager moving forward. Maybe, you know, a fresh start and turning the page on this chapter of the Mets history, maybe that won't loom over players in baseball. Maybe they won't look at the Mets as this situation where they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Well, there has been a common denominator, and that's ownership, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So once you move on from that, maybe that changes. Yeah.
But the other thing, too, is, though, I'm a huge proponent of having the right mix of young and old, right? Like having that, you know, really solid veteran presence, but also having that, you know, young team. They feed off each other, right? Like the young guys bring the energy and the older guys hold the younger guys accountable, showing what it means to be a pro and everything. I mean, there's clearly been a huge void since they've lost David Wright. And they're not flush with, you know, the pros pro kind of, you know, veteran. That's going to, you know, show these guys.
They don't have a Freddie Freeman to set things up for Ronald Acuna and Ozzie Albies and Mike Soroka. They don't have a guy like that in that clubhouse. I mean, I feel like you got guys that want to be leaders. Like Pete Alonso wants to be a leader, but he just doesn't know how. I mean, Jacob deGrom, I feel like his performance lends itself to him being a leader, being a voice in that clubhouse. But I feel like you need an everyday player that can really grab this team by the throat and get them to focus on what the task at hand is and not all the dysfunction around them. Because there's a ton of dysfunction within the organization. They can't get out of their own way. But sometimes players, by virtue of their leadership styles, can get the guys in the clubhouse to focus on what they're doing, and you get decent results. I guess the Mets just don't have that right now. And I guess that's the explanation that we've all been looking for as to why you can have a team as talented as they are underachieve at the start of the season.
I don't think there's any question that they are absolutely lacking that kind of a presence at the moment. And it has to be an everyday player. And you're right. And this is not a knock on Pete, but it feels like he's trying really, really hard to be a leader. And I don't know that you can always be in that situation. Rick, you guys can answer this better than me, but obviously much better. The guys who try to be a leader, do they get people to follow them if they're really outwardly, you know, rah-rah and trying to do it?
No, see, I don't think that's his problem. I think the, you know, when you rely on a guy going into his second year to be your leader, I mean, that's a tall task for a young player, man. I mean, you're trying to focus on, you know, what you're doing on the field, having success, and at the same time trying to lead a group of men. I mean, that is not an easy thing to do. And I don't think he's trying too hard. I mean, I think he's to produce. I think at the moment he's trying too hard because he realizes how important he is to this team. But I mean, that to the original point is that's when you need to have veterans to take some of that pressure off of Pete Alonso, mm-hmm. to feel like he has to be that guy every single day. Because to be a leader, I mean, Carl, it's a choice you make every single day. That regardless of, you know, performance, regardless of what's going on in your life, you show up every single day to that clubhouse and you're the same guy, same energy level, same everything every single day. And that's, you know, most young players grow into that. Like, you'll eventually grow into that role. But that doesn't, I mean, that's, most guys can't handle doing both that early on in a career.
Yep, which is why it's important to have some steady hands in the locker room, veteran presence, guys like Brett Gardner for the New York Yankees. Like, you need players like that around, and it just doesn't feel like the Mets have enough of those guys. They just don't. I mean, the veteran guys that they have around that have the resume are more concerned about themselves than they are about the team's development and trying to get them to a point where they can compete consistently for the playoffs. So, you know, I'm hoping that the change in ownership will change the culture and how they do business. But right now, I mean, it's just too sporadic for me. Like, the Mets are capable of having those offensive outbursts like we saw last night. But even in yesterday's win, there were still things that you want to see them improve on.
I tell you talk about inconsistency. Man, was I disappointed with how the Rangers played yesterday. I mean, that was freaking brutal. I mean, look, I understand that, first of all, let's not turn Mrazek into, you know, Dominic Hasek quite yet.
Yeah, but time out.
He was good.
Listen, by resume, he's not Dominic Hasek. But, I mean, that's all you ask from a goalie in a playoff series.
Yes.
Is to make the saves you're supposed to, and then the occasional, the one you saw in Howden, the one you saw in Zibanejad, like those occasional big saves in big moments.
The one from Howden, the one that was right at him? Yeah, you should make that save.
Rico, how big was the save on the Zibanejad chance at the end of the first period?
It was huge. It was huge. And here's the thing, though. And Chris, I'm going to speak to you in terms of the NFL. What happens with a team like Carolina, in the most important thing headed into tonight's game, is the Rangers have to find some way to score the first goal. Because they get down early, they start chasing. You saw it. I mean, Hank should have had the first one. I'm not going to blame Hank, but that's the kind of save you need to make, knowing the circumstances that you're in. Second goal wasn't great either. But, you know, those two quick ones, you could just tell the bench was just demoralized. When you play a team like Carolina, and the reason why I'm saying the first goal is so important is because once they score the first goal, it's the equivalent of playing a team like the Tennessee Titans, right? And if you let the Tennessee Titans get an early lead, now they can fall back on what they do really well, which is slam the football down your throat with Derrick Henry.
Yeah.
You're not making them uncomfortable. You have to you have to make a team like Carolina uncomfortable, so they do have to take extra chances that when they have the lead, they don't have to take. And Panarin's got to be better. Their top six forwards have to be better. Bottom line. And Hank needed to make a couple big saves last night, and he didn't. Yesterday afternoon, he didn't.
I think, Chris, I look at that, and I thought that Carolina was everything that the Rangers needed to be. You know,
but Carolina's got the experience, too. Let's not forget that. I mean, when you look on paper and you saw the Rangers play the way that they played, you got, I mean, a guy who's, you know, a finalist for the MVP, you know, Zibanejad with the 41 goals, had an unbelievable season. I mean, I think Shesterkin would make a big difference, believe it or not, in this series with how he plays, how he handles the puck. I think that's a huge loss for them. I think losing Lemieux for the first couple games with the amount of, you know, emotion, physicality he can bring would have been a big boost in the first two games. I think you'll see that tonight. But, I mean, this Carolina team was in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. So they have the experience. And right now, their best players, I mean, Aho's been good. Svechnikov had the hat trick last night. I mean, their best players have shown up.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it just seems like the overall intensity for Carolina in the entire 60 minutes is higher than the Rangers. And at some point, the Rangers have got to figure out a way to neutralize that. And I thought that chance that Zibanejad had, I mean, you're talking about them taking the first lead in the series. That would have been huge, not only from a momentum standpoint, but from a confidence standpoint. It just feels like the Hurricanes are more confident than the Rangers right now, and I don't know who's going to help the Rangers shift that dynamic. But it's got to happen in a hurry. It's got to happen tonight, and the odds are against them.
Rick, did you?
This is always the toughest game.
Well, you were talking about the first goal, right? Did you? I didn't think they were really dead until that stretch early in the second period when they scored twice in less than 2 minutes. I thought that's when I thought Rangers are dead here. That's where I thought that the wind.
That's where they gave up the ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
It did feel.
Am I wrong?
That a little bit.
No, you're not wrong. No, you're not wrong. But the point I was making is that, you know,
they need to get off their back.
Well, no, a game against a team like Carolina, who, you know, can clog things up and play that well, put that much pressure on you defensively, is you got to make that team uncomfortable. And the way you make a team like that uncomfortable is getting an early lead, making them chase the game a little bit. And because they scored the first goal again, they can fall back into what they do their best, which is put tons of pressure on you, force turnovers. I mean, you're playing into their strength. And that wasn't a goal. And listen, Hank's a Hall of Famer. We all understand that, and he's carried this team for a long time. But that is, you can ask him. He would tell you, if we had him on the show right now, he would tell you that first goal is unacceptable.
That was a softie. I mean, that looked like a softie on the short side.
They went through him. Yeah, you can't. I mean, you can't let pucks go through you like that. I mean, a short side goal in between, you know, your chest and your blocker is not something Hank would say he should give up.
Rico, you sound like you put this game two loss on him more so than you did the game one loss on him.
No, I mean, it's on the whole team. I don't want to just single him out, but I think it's probably, I think
you're saying that
starts,
he's got more blame in game two than he did in game one.
Well, I just know the effect the goalie has on his team. Like the confidence of a team usually runs through how well your goalie's playing. And you know, that feeds into, you know, your performance on the ice. And to have that happen again after the start of game one, where you lose one of your best players and they score in the first minute. I mean, that's not how you draw it up.
Yeah, they're not a confident team. They're not a confident team right now. And just listening to some of the things that Coach Quinn is saying, it's just like, okay, they're waiting for something to happen. They're waiting for a switch to flip, and it hasn't happened. And so I look at that, and you can tell, you know, after the beginning of that second period, like they just didn't have any confidence. They didn't believe that they could win that game. And so I guess my question is, what's going to change tonight? Because it feels like two dominating performances by Carolina in the first two games of this series.
Well, I think part of what could change is you may see a goalie change. which I would understand. It could be Georgie. I don't know what Shesterkin's availability is. I think bringing Lemieux into his physicality will help kind of set the tone. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing the Rangers lack, because you asked how do they turn it around. I mean, the only way the Rangers really turn it around with how they're constructed is to tie it up or score a goal. Like the beauty of what the Islanders have with their fourth line, it's their energy line. I don't even want to call it a fourth line because that's disrespectful. But like if all of a sudden you're watching an Island game, like you'll watch today, and you know all of a sudden, because we all know sports is about, I mean, NFL, NBA, NHL, it's, you know, once a team, you know, takes hold of the momentum, mm-hmm. how do you capitalize on that momentum? And if you're the other team, how do you stop the momentum? And like when you watch the Islanders, if all of a sudden it's a goal or it's a bad shift or it's a couple bad shifts, you send Cizikas, Martin, and Clutterbuck out, and all of a sudden they're running around smashing people.
Yeah, it's going to get real physical when those guys are on the ice.
Yeah, and all of a sudden now your bench perks up. You're like, okay, all right, we're back. Okay, yep, the ship has been steady. Let's get going. The Rangers don't really have that. They don't have that presence in their lineup.
I'm fascinated to see how that plays out tonight because right now it feels like they're going with a whimper. And I hate to put it that way, but I haven't seen anything in these first couple of games to make me think otherwise.
They got to have a better start. I mean, they have to have a better start. Yeah. I mean, they have to, in my opinion, score the first goal, gain some confidence over, from that. And then, you know, their guys got to show up. I mean, Kreider's got to be better. Panarin's got to be better. I mean, they have to find a way. I mean, that's what separates teams in the playoffs is when, because you know going into a game, you're looking over your game plan. I mean, the Rangers are trying to shut down Svechnikov and Aho, and they haven't been able to do it. And mm-hmm. on the reverse of that, Carolina's trying to shut down Panarin, Zibanejad, and Kreider. And, I mean, Panarin had two shots yesterday. He scored on one and missed it on the other one. That's not enough. Kreider's got to be better. I mean, he's the guy. He's the big, you know, big, fast, physical guy that's got to, you know, set the tone for his team. And for the most part, he hasn't done that.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.